announcement for those of you that are here to testify on 2110. 2110 will not be heard today. And with that, I'll open a public hearing on 2109. John, you want to give us a little idea of what this bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill would address the issue of how pedestrians are to be treated by the motoring public in various kind of intersection-type situations. The intent of the bill would be to standardize that process so that the same set of criteria would apply to both controlled and uncontrolled intersections. The bill would seek to apply the current law as it relates to uncontrolled intersections to both controlled and uncontrolled intersections.
Okay. And we only have one person signed up to testify. Troy?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. House Bill 2109, as Mr. Hauser described to you, is relating to the pedestrian law in the bill. Senate Bill 315 from last session, which rewrote the rules around motor vehicles and pedestrians. In 315, the language is created so the driver in an uncontrolled situation with no lights or signs is having to leave the lane that the pedestrian is in plus one before the vehicle moves through. But in situations where there are lights and signs, the vehicle is basically waiting for that pedestrian to get all the way across the road before they can proceed. House Bill 2109 was pre-filed by ODOT through the governor's office in order to make the treatment of pedestrians with motor vehicles consistent, basically of the lane plus one. And that's basically an attempt to be a cleanup on that particular issue, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions as best I can.
Thank you, Troy. Any questions? And anyone else that hasn't signed up interested in testifying on 2109? The chair proposes that we do a work group for this this bill. And
I would like to, before you take off, I do have a couple of questions.
Sure, certainly. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Excuse me.
Sorry for the delay on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple of questions I have. First of all, the old language says within a marked or unmarked crosswalk, and the proposed new language does not include that distinction. It just says within a crosswalk. Any particular reason for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Early, I can't at this point in time answer the question. I'll have to do a quick evaluation as to where specifically in the bill you might be looking back in.
Section 1.
Okay. Excuse me. Wrong bill. There's a Senate bill filed on the same issue. Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, I can't answer that question for you at this time. I have to go back and research that for you.
Also, in your written testimony here, you say that with the additional language in House Bill 2109, the motorist would be required to treat pedestrians the same at all intersections. Now, the language says crosswalks. And could you help reconcile your written testimony that says at all intersections versus the language that says crosswalks?
Sorry. Chair. I'm reading the other parts of the bill to find out if the situation is where there's an unmarked crosswalk to make sure that it's covered by the current law, so the change to the law isn't needing to address that piece. That's why I'm going back and evaluating the bill real quick here. Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, my understanding is that when we're talking about the pedestrian crossing at legal corners where versus mid-block crossing, the bill is addressing the issue where the pedestrian is crossing at those points that are deemed to be an intersection where the pedestrian could cross. This is not addressing an issue where someone is crossing mid-block where there's no painted crosswalk, because they're not supposed to be there to begin with.
The other comment that I have is Section 1 amends ORS 811.010, which deals with crosswalks that do not have traffic control devices. And then Section 2 amends 811.040, and the language is virtually identical, except for it also includes crosswalks that have traffic control devices. And I'm simply wondering, do we need in the ORS two different sections that basically do exactly the same thing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, the Motor Vehicle Code does designate differently for controlled intersections with lights and signs and uncontrolled. And so 2109 is basically treating the pedestrian issue in both those areas. Senate Bill 492, which was filed just within the last day or two, is attempting to take both those situations and make treating pedestrians, regardless of whether there it's a controlled or uncontrolled intersection, in one particular paragraph instead of two. It is a matter of choice by this body as to whether to continue the language as split or to potentially bring those back together. 2109 is just addressing current law and did not attempt to blend them together.
So again, I'm sorry, the Senate bill number is
492.
Thank you. That was all, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? All right, we'll go back to the work group now. I'll close the public hearing on 2109, and Representative Burley, would you like to be on this work group?
Sure.
Thank you. And any other interested parties out there, we need to do some work on this legislation and in a fairly timely manner. Thank you. Okay. We'll open a public hearing on 2353.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2353 is a bill that would address the potential for the use of certain kinds of combinations of vehicles on the highway. Current law prohibits the use of three passenger type vehicles, if you will, in tandem on a highway. What this bill would do would be to permit a tandem of three vehicles if one were a, if you will, a towing type vehicle that was towing a motorhome. And attached to the motorhome could be a trailer of a particular size, not to exceed 3,500 pounds capacity. The overall length of the combination could not exceed 65 feet.
Thank you. And we'll start with individuals. Let's see. No, there's no one. I was going to start with somebody over 100 miles away, but we don't have anyone signed up. So, Stephen Johnson, I believe you're first signed up. Welcome.
Thank you. Good job.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Johnston. I'm a retired state employee. I live at 660 Sneed Street in Kaiser, Oregon. And I'm asking you not to approve this bill. Way of background, I used to spend about 10 plus so years with the Department of Transportation in charge of the size and weight program. This bill had come up periodically, and it has never been deemed to be a good idea. This bill allows two vehicles to be towed behind another vehicle. If you were to do a commercial, you have to have a commercial driver's license to handle doubles. This has no requirement for any type of licensing. There are a number of reasons that this is not a good idea. You can't back up three combinations of three vehicles, for instance. It's literally impossible. The driver of this combination of vehicles, he can see the vehicle behind him, but he won't see the boat behind that one. He won't even know if it became disconnected, if it has a flat tire, if it's weaving along the road. You can't see it in your rearview mirrors because it's blocked by the second vehicle. Another reason not to approve it is that you're talking about putting a hitch on the back of a trailer to pull another trailer. Trailers aren't designed for this purpose. If you buy a car and want to tow a trailer, you'll have a professionally engineered hitch that is normally installed. In this particular situation, people are going to have makeshift hitches in order to tow the vehicle. So there's a safety issue if those are going to be strong enough, the hitches. Unlike commercial trucks that use air brakes, these vehicles would have to have brakes, and they'd probably be electric brakes. As an RVer myself, I know sometimes it's real hard to get the second brake, adjust it to where you have good braking. With a third brake, it'd be almost impossible to have good, even braking with electric brakes, since they, unlike commercial vehicles, there's the exact same source pushing the air to the air brakes for both vehicles. Most pickups today, which this bill really pertains to, is a pickup pulling a fifth wheel, pulling another trailer. Most pickups today are at their maximum towing limit, usually pulling a trailer, a fifth-wheel trailer. These things are heavy. Putting another vehicle up to 3,500 pounds behind it is something that it will probably overload most pickup trucks. This could also cause handling problems. The state of California, a number of years ago, passed the same law, or pretty much the same law you're talking about today, as HB 2353, but they passed it with a sunset clause. When it came up for renewal, they decided not to continue because of, I would assume, because of problems they had with this type of arrangement. We do have a neighboring state that allows it, and that is Idaho. But I can tell you from experience, the state of Idaho allows lots of commercial vehicles that are a lot longer and a lot bigger than the state of Oregon would allow. They are very liberal in what they allow. The state of Washington does not allow it. California doesn't allow it. And I don't think Oregon should allow it. I have a motorhome, and I tow a car behind that vehicle. And I think it'd be real nice maybe to slap a hitch on the car and tow a boat behind that and have three vehicles in combination. But I don't think this would be a safe combination. To be quite candid with you, I wouldn't drive it because it's not safe. So for Oregon's traveling public, please do not pass this bill. If you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer.
Thank you, Stephen. Any questions?
I wasn't even aware. California does not allow it now?
They had a law, as chairman, they had a law that did allow it. Yeah. And that was about, I think, 7 or 8 years ago. And it had a sunset clause on it. And I believe it was 5 or 6 years ago when it came up for renewal. They had the sunset. They decided not to renew it, and it died.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Greg Del Ponte. Oh, and Gary Miller, excuse me.
Good Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Greg Delponte. I'm the administrator for the Motor Carrier Division of ODOT. The first thing I'd like to observe is that I have learned this afternoon never to share my testimony with Steve Johnson if he's going to testify ahead of me again. So I'll basically endorse much of what you heard Steve say, and I'll just summarize the testimony that you're having by observing that this indeed is a bill, a concept, that has come before the legislature in each of the last three sessions at least, and has never gained passage. And I think there are some good reasons for that. ODOT continues to be very concerned about this particular bill and what it seeks to do. And our concerns broadly fall into three categories. A, the bill would generally allow anyone with a Class C driver's license, like each of you and I probably have in our pockets, to pull a combination set of vehicles up to 65 feet, just about anywhere in the state of Oregon. We don't even let professional truck drivers do commercial driver's license unless they've got an additional credential, a doubles endorsement on their commercial driver's license, which requires them to successfully pass another knowledge test and to obtain that certification. Secondly, I'd venture that most citizens probably are not intimately familiar with the driving challenges that rural Oregon highways present to someone that's pulling a set of doubles. In another career, in another lifetime, I have driven a truck, and I can give you personal testimony that pulling a set of doubles poses some unique difficulties. And just imagine what this would do in real terms as we're adding an additional quantity of extra length vehicles into the traffic already on our freeways and our interstates and in our suburbs. Imagine competing with such a vehicle for a space at a local gas station, if you will. Imagine someone trying to back that up. It is a challenge. I just think there are some difficulties here. Finally, there are some unanswered questions about whether or not RV trailers are engineered to incorporate a trailer hitch. Steve was correct. We actually made a couple of phone calls. We couldn't find a manufacturer that was willing to warrant that their vehicle was manufactured and designed in such fashion that they would want to defend a liability claim if that hitch came loose. So I think there are some issues. And in conclusion, it just seems imprudent to the department to create another category of longer combination vehicles that are going to add to the traffic we already have on our highways and byways.
Question?
Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Chair Dillon, members of the committee. I'm Lieutenant Gary Miller. I'm the Assistant Director of the Patrol Services Division for the Oregon State Police. I've spent my last 27 years in the Patrol Division on this agency, working the highways throughout this state before I came to Salem. And one of my assignments was 17 years in Pendleton. And I had an opportunity at that time to occasionally come across one of these vehicles and have to redirect them back to Idaho. And one of the times I came across them was at a crash site where we tried to turn it around and hit it back. Couldn't do it. Very difficult. We had to disconnect some things and get it going and back home. That's just one little anecdotal information. Something else I'd like to explain to you is the Oregon State Police has some strong concerns with this bill as it's written. I'm a crash reconstructionist, and I have been since 1984, and there are certain dynamic concerns with these vehicles. Have you ever seen a set of triples or doubles going down the road? And you'll see the trailer swaying a little bit. And as you, the first trailer maybe a hair, the second one a little bit more, and the third trailer a little bit more. Rearward amplification and trailers. So the more vehicles you're towing, the more problems you have there. The braking issues that were brought up before me can be a substantial problem in the rear vehicle, and you don't know if the brakes are working on that third vehicle. If the tires lock up, the vehicle may cause it to lose control. That trailer may skid into an opposing lane of travel. There's a number of issues there. I'd also like to bring it to the committee's attention that in my written testimony, I've referred twice to Group 1 highways. Please strike that. That's incorrect. That's when I read the bill. It's difficult for me to understand because it talks about Group 1 and 2. And then in this section where that's bolded, it doesn't reference into anything, so it makes me think it's any place. But basically, anything else I say, I'd reiterate Deputy Director Del Ponte and the person before me who did just an admirable job covering most of the bases. And I'd just like to thank you for your time to testify today and be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for being here today. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, it's just a comment. I serve on a volunteer fire department, and we handle about 14 miles of Highway 26 coast. And coming down the last four lanes, when people are, they see that sign that they're getting close to where they're going to go, and they speed up. And we haven't had triples, we've had doubles, but people are often hauling things that they don't drive normally the rest of the year, and it's the first time. Or, God forbid, a horse trailer full of horses, which we've had too, and when they go down, that's pretty tough. And so anyway, I appreciate your being a crash reconstructionist that you can give us such good advice on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John O'Shill and Jim Weissman. I ruined both those names, I'm sure. But that's okay. Obviously, we got two people up here. State your names to get it right when you start, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John O'Shell, the County Road Program Manager with the Association of Morgan Counties. With me is Jim Beisman, the Public Works Director for Lincoln County. We have a series of handouts coming to you. My intention here is to stall a little bit so those can get in front of you. Not much, because you've heard mostly what you need to hear. Our testimony is going to be focused on the county system, which, you know, when you hear about combination vehicles, usually they're talking to you in terms of heading down a state highway or an interstate. And we're here to tell you that when you move yourself out onto a county road, the story is very different. And these vehicles are heading to locations in rural areas down our county roads. So basically, our issue is we think these things are exceedingly unsafe, both for what they are and what controls are not put on these vehicles to make them safe, and for the total inexperience that we would expect from this type of driver. The handouts you have, we have a handout from Clackamas County that actually has visual pictures of what it might be to try and get these vehicles through several intersections. You have the testimony of Jim Beisman, who will be here. You have a testimony from Washington County. The testimony from Association of Oregon Counties also has a couple other counties attached. It also has the Washington County one. I was hitting the road fast before we had one with signatures. It just arrived while I was sitting here, so you have Washington County twice, but it's the same testimony. With that, I think I'll pass it off to Jim Beisman, and then I'll do clean up with as brief as I can on anything I haven't heard mentioned before.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as John said, I'm Jim Beisman, Public Works Director for Lincoln County. I did not share my testimony with the previous two witnesses, but you're going to think that I did. I have some concerns about the vehicle that would be allowed under 2353, a pickup with a fifth wheel, and then what is termed a small trailer behind. And I would suggest, first of all, that under the definition of small at 3,500 gross weight, that isn't really true. That would be, in my view, a significant trailer behind the first trailer. My concerns are basically, first of all, about the brakes or braking system on such a proposed vehicle and the ability of those brakes, if there are brakes on all the axles even, to adequately control and stop a vehicle, particularly if there's a panic stop or in slippery conditions. This vehicle is going to have two pivot points, and I can easily envision that, particularly in some kind of a panic stop, that this thing will jackknife or otherwise have serious problems. I'm concerned about people's ability to pass a combination. At 65 feet, this combination will require a significant passing distance. I'm from Lincoln County, and those of you that have driven our coastal county roads and our state highways know that it isn't often that we have real significant passing distance. I'm concerned that these vehicles are going to be towed by a pickup, which may not be able to reasonably move this thing down the road, and the drivers behind that vehicle will become frustrated and try to pass in locations where they should not. And you can see my previous comment then with regard to passing distances.
I'm concerned that the average operator won't be able to back this up. I run a road department. We have professional drivers who drive basically the biggest combinations on the road and combinations with multiple pivot points. And I can tell you that it takes a very skilled operator to back up a vehicle with more than one pivot point for even more than a short distance. Even those guys who drive the rigs every day have trouble with that one. I'm concerned, and I mentioned it a moment ago, that this small trailer isn't really small at 3,500 pounds. That's almost 2 tons, and I suggest that's a significant amount of weight behind a pickup, even a relatively large one. And in any event, should this bill move ahead, I'd strongly recommend that it include a provision that this combination of the towed trailers not exceed the manufacturer's suggested towing weight. And I believe that you'll find in most all, if not all, modern pickups that the manufacturer will provide that information to you. I'm concerned that these operators will not be able to adequately see that second trailer. Typically, these fifth-wheelers that we see on the road behind a pickup are at maximum width to provide room for the individuals that are occupying them. And that means that more than likely this small, quote-unquote, trailer that will be behind will be narrower and therefore not visible really to the operator. If that's the case, I don't see how that they're going to, for instance, safely make any lane changes. We do have some 3- and 4-lane sections in Lincoln County, like through the city of Newport. How are they going to be able to see that? How are they going to adequately be able to observe so that they can move back and forth? And they will need to do that some. And lastly, I'm concerned that the typical RV operator probably will not be competent to drive a 65-foot-long combination, again, with these two pivot points. When we hire people to drive something of that length and of that type, we see to it that they're specifically trained. We see to it that they're specifically licensed. And I see nothing in this bill that would provide for that kind of competency examination before you turn somebody loose on the road with one of these things. In summation, I think that 2353 would allow on our state highways and county roads and city streets vehicles that represent an unacceptable and unnecessary safety risk to the general public, and I urge you to reject it. With that, I'll turn it back to John. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions?
I was going to go very brief. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, just very quick closure. And I basically have my notes here, and I've been scratching stuff that's been said, so it'll be very brief. When we talk about the lead vehicle not having enough power, as written, you could have some guy driving a Chevy Love with someone plopped a fifth wheel in the back of with a full trailer towing a Honda CR-V. This thing says small trailer, but your mid-size CRVs, mid-size RVs, are under 3,500 pounds. This is a horrific something to be heading down any road, much less a county road to a park. Most of the rest areas on 101, if those guys turned into them, they're not getting back out. It's that simple. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, John. Question, Representative.
Do you think the intent was maybe the pickup with a fifth wheel and a boat on a trailer?
Our suspicion, and we've been asking ourselves the same question, who wanted this? And the guess is it probably is a pickup with a big fifth wheel RV with either a boat or a trailer towing motorcycles or snowmobiles.
Yeah.
That's our guess as to who it's for. And once again, think about where those folks are going. Mm-hmm. They're going to get themselves in trouble.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else to testify on 2353? Close the public hearing on 2353. And open a public hearing on 2106. John, do you want to give us a little...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill was pre-session filed by ODOT. Its intent is to provide the department the flexibility of providing by rule reasons for which they can issue a replacement driver's license, driver's permit, or identification card. Currently, the law restricts their ability to issue a replacement to the specific reasons that are enumerated in the statute. This bill would retain all of the existing statutory reasons for allowing a replacement, but it would also give them the additional flexibility of being able to add reasons to that list by rule.
Thank you. Robin, we're ready.
Good afternoon, Chair Dillon, members of the committee. Oregon law provides for only three types of driver license or ID card transactions: original issue, renewal, and replacement.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can you pull that mic over towards you? One of them or the other.
Can you hear me? Thank you. And for the record, I'm sorry, Robin Freeman here today representing the Oregon Department of Transportation. Oregon law provides for only three types of driver license or ID card transactions: original issue, renewal, and replacement. An original issue transaction is the first time a license or ID card is issued to a person. A renewal transaction extends the expiration date of the license or ID card, and a replacement transaction covers all other situations. Statutes only allow the department to issue a replacement license or ID card when a license or ID card has been lost, destroyed, or mutilated, a name or address has changed, or a new number is requested due to fraudulent use. Other situations warrant the issuance of a replacement license or ID card, rather than requiring people to purchase a new original license or ID card. Customers should not be required to pay higher original fees for certain transactions when the replacement fees more closely reflect the department's issuance costs. House Bill 2106 gives the department authority to determine by administrative rule the criteria for issuing a replacement driver's license or ID card. The department believes that issuing a replacement license or ID card is appropriate in the following situations: adding or removing license endorsements or restrictions, replacing a license or ID card when a person reestablishes residency in Oregon after moving to another state, exchanging a valid without photo license for a license with a photograph, replacing a license or ID issued in error, issuing a license or ID after reinstatement of suspension or cancellation, or issuing a license or ID confiscated by law enforcement. The department's policy has been to handle most of these scenarios as replacements. A strict reading of the statute would preclude this practice. We ask the committee to support House Bill 2106. It amends current law that restricts the issuance of replacement license or ID cards to specific situations. It creates statutory authority for the department to set eligibility criteria in administrative rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Questions? Oh, everything.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From a physical standpoint, if I'm looking at a replacement license, new license, these various categories, what's the actual physical look difference between what we now require you to do in the statute and what you would be able to do if this passes by administrative rule?
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, there's no difference in what we issue. Simply the fee is different due to statute.
So really what this is doing is making it easier not only for DMV but for the individual by making it more clear under what cases they can get a replacement license or permit, and also makes it clear that they're paying the lower replacement fee instead of the new origination fee.
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, that's exactly right.
Follow up.
One other question I had. On page 3 of the bill, item 5, you talk about the driver license or driver permit replaced under this section is invalid and shall be surrendered to the department or destroyed. And I'm curious why not just require it be surrendered? Who would be destroying it? Why not just drop off the ore destroyed?
I don't have an answer for that, but I will get back to you on that. I would imagine so that it doesn't fall into the wrong hands, but I don't want to assume that's the answer.
That's why I would think we should just say it has to be surrendered to the department. Leave it at that.
Further questions? Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify on 2106? Close the public hearing on 2106 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Fire moves 2106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I would like to explore amending that language, because with today's concerns about ID theft, I would just assume if we're going to replace it, that the old one be surrendered to the department. That way we can assure that it's being adequately
destroyed. It's not going to be out in circulation somehow. I'm not going to accept your motion, Representative Fire, and we will close the work session on 2106 and depend on Representative Burley to come up with some amendments. Open the public hearing on 2114. John, give us a little summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2114 is a bill that would clarify, or seeks to clarify, legislation that the Legislative Assembly adopted during the last legislative session that would require vehicle dealers or towing business certificate holders to remove the registration stickers on passenger motor vehicles with a gross weight of 8,000 pounds or less. The requirement would specify that this requirement specifically not include motorcycles, mopeds, or snowmobiles, and existing exemptions to the requirement would be retained. The bill has an emergency clause and would become effective upon passage. The legislation that the Assembly adopted during the 2003 session, according to representatives from ODOT, was intended to apply only to passenger-type motor vehicles. However, the broadness of the language that was used would, in theory, allow the language to be applied to things such as motorcycles, mopeds, snowmobiles, motorhomes, campers, trailers, a broad range of both motorized and non-motorized types of vehicles. What ODOT has introduced this bill to do is to provide for what they believe was your original intent in passing the earlier legislation, that was to have it limited to passenger-type motor vehicles.
Thank you, John. We have four individuals signed up. Robin, are you ready again?
Good afternoon again, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robin Freeman. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Department of Transportation. The Bureau of Transportation is requesting this bill to help clarify changes made by passage of House Bill 2388 during the 2003 legislative session. The 2003 legislation requires a vehicle dealer or tow company to scrape off the registration stickers from the license plate when they sell a vehicle but are not processing the paperwork for their customer. If they are processing the paperwork for the customer, the registration stickers can stay on the plates for the customer to use. It also allows the dealer or tower to issue a 10-day trip permit for the vehicle when the stickers are scraped off so the customer can drive the vehicle. This bill aligns statute with current practice and legislative intent. During the 2003 legislative session, House Bill 2388 was passed to address the problem of citizens who buy passenger vehicles based on the amount of registration time left on the vehicle. These citizens fail to transfer title or registration into their name, and it is alleged that they don't purchase liability insurance for the vehicle. In the legislative testimony and in discussions between the department and industry representatives, agreement was reached to apply the scraping of registration stickers to the passenger vehicles only. There was no discussion of having the same problems with other types of vehicles, such as recreational vehicles. The current statute was written broadly and includes all vehicle types, both motorized and non-motorized. However, the statute that allows for the issuance of a 10-day permit when a sticker is scraped only allows for the permit to be issued to a motor vehicle. This also implies that the bill is intended to apply only to passenger vehicles. Passenger vehicles account for 87% of the vehicle records on DMV systems, with all the other vehicle types included in the other 13% of DMV's records. House Bill 2388 was implemented as intended and only applied to passenger vehicles, which covers the majority of the vehicles. This bill aligns statute with legislative intent and current practice. It requires the stickers to be scraped from passenger vehicles only. It continues to allow for the 10-day trip permit to be issued. This bill eliminates any potential confusion for vehicle dealers and towers on what vehicles a registration sticker must be scraped from. We ask for your support on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Questions?
Yeah. Sorry, Robin.
That's okay.
It makes perfect sense. I don't see any real problem with it. However, in the statutes, Chapter 801 is where all the definitions are, if I'm not mistaken, for transportation-related matters. There is a definition at Section 360 for motor vehicle, but that's not the same as what is here on lines 9, 10, and 11 of this bill. So I'm curious, are we basically creating a new definition for transportation matters? And if so, might it not make more sense just to be consistent to take this out of 565 and put it into 801 somewhere?
Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, I can't answer that specifically, but I can tell you that at the time they were creating this, they were trying to target a four-passenger vehicle. Motor vehicle. I can ask that question and get back to you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Byer.
I'm not quite sure this answers your question as to whether we should be doing one or the other. I do know that when we discussed this last year, the problem was we just didn't even question the use of motor vehicles or of the motor vehicle, and didn't even think about and have the discussion about whether this should take in any other type of vehicles. We just assumed we were talking about passenger cars and not the other ones. And so the problem was the definition of motor vehicles, and by narrowing that in this bill to those motor vehicles that are this size and less clarifies the problem. So whether or not you want to address the statutes and try to change them, I guess is another issue. But that's the reason this is written the way it is.
And I appreciate that, but I'm... Section 801.360 defines motor vehicle as motor vehicle means a vehicle that is a self-propelled or designed for self-propulsion. There's no definition in 801 for a passenger vehicle. And that's why I'm asking, are we, by these three lines in this bill, creating a definition for a passenger vehicle? If so, I suggest we put it in 801.
And I need Chair Gilman, Representative Burley, I will ask that question and get back to you on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Al Elkins.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Ogre and Totuck Association. We have submitted an amendment to the bill, and I believe you have that in your packet. And what that amendment does is amends line 20 of the bill. Ms. Freeman talked earlier about the history of 2288, and in that bill, we are allowed to not scrape the sticker if we sell the vehicle to a dealer or if we sell it to a wrecker. This amendment puts into this section of the statute the portion relating to wrecker because it was left out. The stuff that we sell to wreckers are usually junk. Those that are going to be dismantled or crushed. So that is why we need that in this statute, is it so it complies with the original intent of House Bill 2288. And that's the purpose of the amendment. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Alan. Questions?
No.
Thank you very much. Monty King.
My name is Monty King, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Monty King. I'm the president of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association, a little different role from last session. And I was involved in House Bill 2388's formation last session. And I want you to know that I did a survey of motorcycle dealers before it was passed, and they agreed that motorcycle stickers should be taken off just like everybody else. Now, I know that wasn't in committee. We never really talked about it. But the intent of the legislation, as far as I was concerned, members that I had at that point, was it should be one thing fits all as far as sticker scraping. When you have vehicles out there that are being driven around, they're not titled, they're not licensed in a person's name, they're not registered in their name, they don't have insurance, is that the public policy that you want to have for the state of Oregon? And do you not want all that income for your road fund? I think that's really the question here. It's not whether it's easy for one person or another, or if you can get a trip permit to fit on the back of a motorcycle or something. I mean, there's other ways of doing that. I can come up with 10. Okay? That's what tape is for. But it was something that we at least had talked about, and then I did, and maybe we didn't talk about it in committee. But when I was asked, would the industry, except instead of removing the plates from vehicles, would the industry also accept that when we went to, instead of taking plates off vehicles that weren't transferred, to taking the tags off, would the industry do that at the same time? And the industry came back and said, yes, we would. And as part of that survey, when I called those dealers, I called 6 motorcycle dealers. One of them didn't like government at all. It didn't matter. The other 5 said, absolutely, we need to be just the way everybody else is. This is the fair thing. And as far as the car dealers and everybody else, they said, yes, everybody should be the same. Now, I don't know who this bill really helps, but it's not the honest guy. It's not the trustworthy guy. It's not the person who puts insurance on their vehicle. It's not the one who drives right down to DMV and titles and registers a vehicle in their name. So I don't really know who this bill is helping, but it is a fix for what was perceived to be a mistake. But I don't, I don't really know if it is a mistake. And I really would appreciate it, and I think the members that I have now would appreciate it, if you thought about this in a bigger scope. I know there's going to be another bill down the line that says if a person who buys a vehicle at a dealership takes that title and goes down to DMV and titles the vehicle in their name and comes back to the dealership, that they don't have to take the sticker off. What's wrong with that alternative? And if they don't want to do that, if they don't want to title them, you know, in their name, then why do you want to let them drive it around for the next 6 months, 9 months, up to 24 months without titling, registering their name on their own name and paying the fees into the road fund that they should be paying for the use of the highways? I believe there's also a problem with the counties as far as vehicles that are abandoned. There's a lot of problems out there and have been. I think it's going away, because more and more vehicles are being titled and registered, and when they are abandoned, people know where, who the last person to own them. There's also the back of the title. It went from 3 endorsements. When was the last time you saw a title? There's 3 endorsements on the back of a title, if you remember. There's now only 1. Now that's because of work that I did before, basically. So now you have 1 endorsement on the back of the title. So now when you sell your vehicle to somebody else, you're going to sign off and they're going to sign on. And now most people are going to go to DMV at that point and title it, because there was never a reason for 3 endorsements on the back. We believe those kind of things will do more to bring money into the road fund that should be there, get people to title and register the vehicles and have insurance on them. Basically, I appreciate if you look at this as far as the policy you're creating of letting people out on the highway. And who are they? Are they terrorists? Are they criminals? Are they just people that shouldn't be out there? Are they drunk drivers? You might even go farther and start taking a look at the other half of the people who are selling vehicles and not titling them or registering them, and that's the private party selling to another private party. There is a huge amount of income there that you're losing. It was said in committee last session. I don't know if some of the members remember that. At that point, DMV said they were only getting half of the title fees they should have been. I think that has really been improved by House Bill 2388. But there's still a significant amount of income for the road fund that's out there because of that huge loophole. I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Monty. Questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Monty, you did talk specifically about motorcycles. Do you have a specific, does your perspective also apply to other recreational vehicles, non-passenger recreational vehicles, and things like mopeds and snowmobiles that obviously wouldn't?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, I don't think those are titled. I'm looking at the things that are titled that should be on the road, that you have driver, you have insurance on, liability insurance. Certainly, if those things still get dumped on public land and on private land, out in the forests, wherever. I mean, these people just dump this stuff. Especially if they're coming out of a possessory lien sale someplace where they're kind of junk anyway, and but there are funds that are supposed to be going to the road fund for those things too. When you put a 3,000 pound camper on the back of a pickup, that pickup now weighs 3,000 more and it uses the road more. Where's the way the road? And that's what the title fee increase from, if you remember, in 1999 we went from $10 to 30, and then last session went from 30 to 55. That extra money is what you decided you wanted to have for the roads and bridges. Now here's another chunk that you're not getting because DMV had decided, well, let's go back and have this decision made as policy. I don't fault that decision. I think the legislature should make this policy. But are you going to do it for across the board and legitimately for everybody? Or are you going to cut out little segments of a population that you don't want them to pay what they're supposed to pay, and you don't think it's important for them to have their insurance and registration the way they should? I mean, that's the policy decision. I don't fault DMV for bringing this back to you. But there is a chunk of money here that you can put into the road fund again. And it should be, those people should, the members, all the members I've talked to in 7 years say, people need to pay for their use of the highway. And the title fee is part of that fee. I hope that answered your question.
Further questions?
Thanks, Lonnie. Darrell Fuller. Welcome, Darrell.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, which is the association representing franchise new car dealers. Sitting before you this afternoon reminds me a little bit of my time at Brixner Junior High School in Klamath Falls, where all the girls were at one side of the gym and all the boys were at the other. I'm not quite sure why you guys worked it out that way, but whatever makes you feel best, I guess. Don't have a particular interest in the policy decision that you have before you, which is whether you're going to make everybody scrape the stickers or a certain class of vehicles. I think part of the reason this bill was, or the original bill 2 years ago, was because people were buying vehicles that had time left on the registration ticket, and they wouldn't have to transfer the title. They could use it to cook meth, dump it on the side of the road. It would go back to the previous owner. I don't think too many people are buying semi-trucks to do that. So the idea of eliminating commercial vehicles from the sticker scraping requirement might make some sense. My concern is with the language in sub B on line 10, where it says it's primarily designed to carry passengers. The line A at 8,000 pounds or less gets rid of all the commercial vehicles. But when you go down to line B, primarily designed to carry passengers, I think you're unintentionally eliminating every pickup in the state of Oregon. And there's a lot of people who buy pickups. And I would argue that somebody could say that my pickup is not primarily designed to carry passengers. My pickup is primarily designed to carry dirt or bricks or whatever else I'm doing with it. So I just have a technical concern. If the purpose here is to get at vehicles that are primarily used for household purposes or family uses, you might try to get legislative counsel to come up with a more specific term that deals with the kind of vehicles you're getting at. If, in fact, DMV is not wanting to scrape stickers off of pickup trucks, then I think what you have here is appropriate. We tried to get a hold of the appropriate person who's not available until after 3 o'clock, so we couldn't get this question answered prior to you guys hearing that bill, so I apologize for that. But I would encourage the committee to have DMV make sure that this language is actually accomplishing what they're trying to accomplish, since that didn't happen 2 years ago and we're back again this time. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Question. Thank you. Anyone else interested in testifying on 2114? The chair's intention was to move this bill. We're not going to do it today. We need a definition or two.
Mr. Chair, my request would be if we could ask Robin to come up and maybe we can clarify a few issues, go over what questions we need answered by her if she comes back with this bill, if that would be appropriate.
It's fine if you're willing, Robin.
Benefit me, thank you. Again, Representative Gilman, members of the committee, Robin Freeman, representing the Department of Transportation.
My interest, and I don't know if there's been anything said since you were up that you have discovered an answer for, but I know that there are some questions that people are wanting answers to, and I want to make sure that we have the answers to those when we come back to this bill.
I understand. Representative Gilman. Representative Byer, thank you. Did you want me to clarify the questions as I understand them?
Yes.
I'm going to be reviewing the definition for passenger vehicle, basically, and make sure that we're not creating a new definition for passenger vehicle with this bill under Section 1 on lines 9, 10, and 11. Mr. Fuller has a concern about the fact that line 10, subsection B, eliminates pickup trucks, and I'm going to be making sure that that is the original intention. If not, that we change it to include those while not creating a new definition for passenger vehicle. And I'm not quite sure beyond that what you'd like me to clarify.
I guess the question is, what capacity do we have now? If we include all these, is there a process in place to handle this? Would we have to establish new process to do this? As we include these other things, would we require the department to do that?
I think the short answer to that is we do not know. We don't have a complete process, but I need to find out what we need to do to have a complete process. I know that the permit issue, if this becomes all-inclusive, excuse me, Chair Gilman, Representative Beyer, if we make this all-inclusive, the permit issue will have to be addressed. The permit issue being that we can only at this time issue two 10-day permits to a passenger motorized vehicle. At least that's all that the car dealers, used car dealers, and some towers can issue. So those are things that we would definitely have to address.
Thank you. And just one quick follow-up is I want to say that this was an interesting process last session. It was good. I know it wasn't a department bill, so it probably was not written as clear as maybe we would have liked it to have been, so that we would have been having the discussion on what we were including or not including. But it really was a good bite at the problem we have out there. If you're looking at covering 87% of the vehicles, I think we made a very good start. And I hope we can clarify all of this stuff and get this all taken care of. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Robin, one other question I'd like to ask you to look into is in respect to Mr. King's testimony about concerns on excluding. I mean, there's probably several things, but motorcycles does come to mind. I mean, it's a passenger carrying vehicle. It's licensed, it's titled, etc. Snowmobiles, mopeds, I'm not sure about some of the others, but if you could look at some of these others, and I mean, maybe the numbers are so low that it doesn't justify it, perhaps, but if you could take a look at that, I'd appreciate it.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Close the hearing on 2114 and open the hearing on 2223.
Don. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2223 is a piece of legislation introduced by the Department of Justice. It seeks to repeal two statutory provisions that deal with the solicitation of either employment or money or contributions alongside our state highways. The provisions of those two sections were declared unconstitutional by the courts several years ago, and therefore the department has introduced this bill to repeal those two sections of law.
All right, Kevin Neely.
Thank you, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I'm the Executive Assistant to the Attorney General, and I'm here to support House Bill 2223. It's not every day that I have to come here and support panhandling, but the courts have told me I need to do that today, and so here I am. Back in 1996, the Court of Appeals struck down the statute that you have in front of you. That's ORS 814090. Since 1996, officers hopefully irregularly, still cite folks for panhandling. And when they cite those folks, of course, what often happens is they get sued. And when they get sued, unfortunately, they don't have a lot of defenses because the law is unconstitutional. If you look in the statutes, when a law does get declared unconstitutional, there's no reflection in Oregon statutes that they don't put a big red stamp on it that says, please don't enforce this law is unconstitutional. Unfortunately, the officers need to know. We've done our best to try and educate them, but obviously, there are a lot of citizens who want to do things about panhandling, and so they push the officers. Officers look in the books, they see the statute there, and occasionally they cite to it. I'll just demonstrate this anecdotally through one case. We had a case about 3 years ago that, in fact, ODOT was a party in, not because they actually issued the citation, but because an officer issued a citation on their behalf on a public street. That case settled for $40,000. And so we feel even for that one case, it merits getting this statute off the books so officers aren't aren't citing it and public agencies aren't incurring additional costs. There have been at least three settlements I'm aware of. In that particular case, $39,000 went to the trial attorney, $1,000 went to the panhandler. And so again, I think here what we really want to see is hopefully some insulation for public agencies. Very straightforward here. I put what the bill does and what the bill does not do in the testimony that I provided you in written form. I think the only thing I'd highlight in the what it does not do, I've gotten a number of phone calls. It clearly does not have anything to do with prostitution. All we're talking about here is panhandling. And unfortunately, or fortunately for some people, we are going to make it clear that there is no statutory ban on panhandling. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Oh.
I want to hear this question.
I got to get Representative Burley some balance here. Kevin, I understand the 090 deletion fully. Can you talk about the 092 deletion about the permit for solicitation by fire service professionals? Is it just that it wouldn't be needed because 090 is repealed?
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, that's exactly right. Because we can't stop them from soliciting. There's no necessity to require them to formulate these plans. Now, I was just talking with ODOT, and whether or not they still do that, I don't know if they will or they won't. But again, if we can't keep them from soliciting, we certainly don't need a carve out for how they're going to undertake these solicitations. So I think, again, it's just if you knock down one, you knock down two. Our request to LC actually didn't knock down that second one. They told us that it was, at least the bill came back in this form.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. Along that same thinking, I guess I'm surprised that 080 related to solicitation of a ride doesn't also get knocked out for the same reason.
Chair Gilman, Representative Hunt, I can tell you that we were contacted by Representative Avakian early in the session, and he was hoping to try and find a way to make this statute work. And we looked directly at the hitchhiking statute, essentially solicitation for a ride. And it turns out, one, that statute's never been, so far as we could tell, never been challenged, which may make a difference. And two, the real key to Article 1, Section 8, the state's free speech laws, is conduct. And in a case where you have someone soliciting a ride, the possibility of them actually getting into a vehicle with someone, it turns out that we believe that there's actually some pretty good insulation there, because that is conduct, and it's conduct that could in fact lead to injury. In some instances, I think we've all heard horror stories about either the hitchhiker or the person who picks up the hitchhiker being victimized in some way. And so we think that there is at least a tangential tie between conduct and hitchhiking, whereas the courts have determined now on at least four occasions that there is no claim for conduct in these panhandling cases. Hope that answers your question, Representative. And again, but I think the underlying key is we haven't had to defend that yet. That will be a challenging defense, no doubt.
Further questions? Representative Byer.
Not really a question. I just want to comment on the fact that in 1996, I was a city councilor in the city of Springfield. So I have very much familiarity on this issue, and that's a frustrating issue to deal with, but I can understand why we're doing it. So,
if I could, just one last thing. I know you have other business to conduct, Chair Representative Byer. Interestingly enough, just last month in the Register Guard, there was a full three-page article about an officer who was citing people for panhandling. And so, again, I think it recognizes, and I pulled just in a cursory review of articles in the newspaper over the last 4 years, I pulled five separate articles in which we had cases in which officers cited for panhandling, and then were trying to convince their other co-officers to do that. And again, it's not a question of these officers not understanding the law. If you read the statutes, it appears that the statute is still valid. So, again, it necessitates us taking this out. Pretty easy step.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The officer at issue in Eugene was also spray painting on the sidewalk, no soliciting signs. In front of local businesses.
I don't think there's any further questions, Kevin. Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else that would like to testify on 2223? I'll close the public hearing on 2223 and open a work session on 2223.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I move that House Bill 2223 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representing Thatcher moves House Bill 2223 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. No discussion. I think we'll call the roll, Mike.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Beyer?
Aye.
Representative
Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Terry Gilman?
Aye.
Motion carries. Consent? Can we do that on consent?
I wonder if you might have some questions on that particular bill if it comes to the floor.
And Representative Broome, how would you like to carry this bill?
I think I'd be honored to carry this bill. It's the very first bill I carry, one that actually announces that panhandling is okay. So great. Thank you for that honor, Chair. Great start to my illustrious political career.
Thank you very much. Anything? Oh, let's see. Almost. I apologize to you. Come on up.
He's so quiet.
You said that.
Sign up. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am James Whitty. I'm the manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding, which covers a couple of different programs. I have with me Betsy Eimholt, who's the administrator of the Road User Fee Task Force and the Mileage Fee Pilot Project. Thank you for your invitation today to come and present the work we've been working on for over 3 years now. This work that we're involved in it really comes at the direction of the legislature. In 2001, the legislature passed a bill to investigate the rapid increases in fuel efficiency of some very new vehicles that were coming into the marketplace at the time, and see if we might come up with an alternative revenue source to the gas tax. And so we've spent quite a bit of time doing that. You can see the mandate there to develop a new design for revenue collection for Oregon's roads and highways that will replace the current system. This is the budget for ODOT, and this is the fundamental reason why we're here talking about this. In 2004, you can see various makeup. You probably had a budget overview up to this point already. This is very similar to other states, except for we still have low registration and title fees, despite the recent increases. We also receive our truck revenues through the wave mile tax, as opposed to diesel tax other states have. But here's the real point. We are heavily dependent on the gas tax for our revenue, 68% in 2004. And when you take into account that under cost responsibility, the cost allocation policy of the state, that our truck revenues, the rates for that are dependent on what the gas tax revenues are, we are 86% dependent on our level of gas tax revenues coming into the state. This is a look into the future. The orange line assumes no changes in fuel efficiency of the vehicles. It basically projects the current makeup of automobiles into the future.
The middle line, the blue line, assumes a small change in the rate of fuel efficiency improvements for the vehicles. These are ODOT assumptions from a few years ago. They do not take into account the growth in hybrid electric vehicles or the projection of the use of fuel cell vehicles into the future. Now, the pink line, the lower line, is an internal ODOT forecast prepared for the task force displays realistic changes to fuel tax revenues based on the new vehicles coming into the marketplace. As you can see, there's quite a drop-off. It flattens out in just a few years, and then around 2014 it goes into a permanent decline. The first year of decline isn't much. It's a sliver, but it's permanent, and it continues to drop off dramatically after a few years. So this is the problem we're trying to address, and this is the problem the legislature in 2001 saw and asked us to address. This is the conclusion of the task force. So what do we do about this? The task force looked at 28 different revenue sources and presented a report on those to the 2003 legislature. A report is coming to this legislature later on, updating it. But basically, the solution task force recommended is a mileage fee, a per mile charge to replace the per gallon charge, gas tax, ultimately. It's based on vehicle miles traveled within this state. This mileage fee would operate much like the gas tax did in 1960, when roughly all the vehicles got around 10 miles to the gallon. There were a couple of vehicles like the Volkswagen Beetle that got better gas mileage, but most cars got around 10 miles to the gallon. The gas tax then operated like a mileage fee. Additional driving on the roads created additional needs for the roads, and the person who drove paid for it. That's the concept. But we've separated from that in recent years when the stratification of fuel efficiency changed, and that's going to happen even more into the future. Now, the task force asked us to come up with a way to collect a mileage fee that met all these policy requirements here, and they're quite daunting when we started out. The affordability, they didn't want to see a large bump in the tax rate compared to the gas tax. It should be roughly the same, they thought. There should be no potential for hiccups in the system, and that it should be accurate and reliable. That the mileage should only be collected within the state, and we should not be taxing anybody for driving outside the state. The technology used should be reliable, feasible, and secure. That we should ensure that the privacy of motorists would be protected, and that the evasion potential should not be any greater than what the gas tax is today, and that when we burden the private sector, it shouldn't be any more than what the gas tax is today. And then they also asked for a seamless transition, that there be no lost revenues during the transition. This was rather a daunting task. The collection possibilities that were examined, including human data gathering, this idea was discussed in the 1990s. The idea was called a VMT tax then. It got caught up in very difficult problems with collection. If you use the human element, which makes sense, either self-reporting or you send an ODOT employee out to check the odometer, we actually costed that out and checked the reliability of those two possibilities and rejected them quickly. You can understand why we might reject the self-reporting as a possibility, but if you start to count up the cost of having ODOT employees go out and check odometers, it rises quickly. So that was not really an option. We looked into centralized collection, basically a central place where you send out a monthly billing. I ran into terrific problems there. The administrative costs are huge, actually. Mailing alone is huge, a huge cost. Also, bad debts. We didn't have a way to make sure people paid. That not everybody has a credit card or bank account that they draw on. Plus, there was no way to have a gas tax credit. If you don't want people to pay both, you want them to pay the new tax and give up the old one, how do you have a credit? Very difficult. Tollway style collection also had similar problems, plus building the infrastructure all around the state was very exorbitant from a cost perspective. So we came down with the Oregon concept, where I'm going to have Betsy go into this. She's the new administrator for the task force. And this idea has been around a while, but I can tell you today we believe we've made this practical. It could be implemented. And so this is our concept. This is basically Oregon's contribution to this problem. Transportation officials, what did I say? Did I say that? Oregon's contribution to the solution to the problem. Transportation officials across this country are concerned about the long-term future of the gas tax. It's being studied a number of places. We think this is our contribution to that solution to that problem. There may be others that come, but this one's looking more and more interesting. So we've determined how to make this practical, and Betsy will describe how.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Betsy Eimholt with the Department of Transportation. As Jim alluded to, our concept is based on a per-mile charge within the state. And right now, what we're proposing is this would just be an Oregon thing, although lots of other states are looking at what we're doing. And so we are having just preliminary theoretical discussions about how this could work on a national basis should we want to go there. Because with all the research that we're doing, we don't want to kind of go down a path where the industry maybe going headed down another. And so that's been something that we've been working on lately. So per mile charge based within Oregon, here's how it works. There's two slides, this one and the next one, that really kind of go into the technology. There's an on-vehicle device, which is basically a fancy odometer that keeps more than one mileage total. It will keep a minimum of two, Oregon miles and miles driven outside of Oregon. We don't care where outside of Oregon, but if you're not on Oregon roads, the idea is that you wouldn't be charged for driving on those roads. There is a communication that has to be sent from somewhere to the car so that the odometer knows where to put those miles. And this is important because a lot of people think that ODOT's tracking people or that we're going to measure where everyone's driving on these roads, and that's not at all what we're doing. Literally, the only thing that's kept is these mileage totals within zones. So a minimum of two. You could have more if you wanted to do something like rush hour in downtown Portland. You could create something like that. That's really a policy decision. We will be testing it to see if if the technology works that way. That is one of the things that our agreement with FHWA says that we have to do. And so we will be doing that just to see if it works. The little antenna that you see up there that says switching device, this can be done in a number of ways. For the pilot, we are using a GPS-based unit. Now, see how the line says signal sent. It's one way. The signal is sent to the car. There's no communication back up to the satellite, which is why we will have no idea where you were at any given time and there's no tracking involved. But just to be honest, there is reservations when people hear the word GPS. They think that that means a whole bunch of things that this doesn't mean. You don't have to use GPS, however, if you wanted to use infrastructure. What do you call them, gantries? A tollway-style collection, basically, where you have some, you know, infrastructure set up so when you cross the border, it could do the same thing, basically create a switch in the device to switch it from zone to zone. The GPS, obviously, is what we're doing with the pilot because we're not going to go put up a bunch of infrastructure all over the state to see if it works. So that's what we're proposing there. The second slide is how the rest of the technology works. Basically, what happens is the car with its odometer readings pulls into a service station, and those miles are read by a little unit that will be by the pump. So the concept here is you still pay at the pump just as you do now when you pay your gas tax. You pull into the pump, your miles are transmitted, and it's added to your bill, and the gas tax is deducted. Now, how it works is the gas station knows when a car pulls in if it is a mileage vehicle or not, because it's either going to get a signal or it's not. And if it doesn't get a signal, then you just pay the mileage or the gas tax just like you do now. And if it does get a signal, then the point of sale system will do the calculation and the receipt will show, and we'll show you one in a minute, where the gas tax is deducted and the mileage fee is added for how many miles you've driven since you last paid. Yeah.
Just a quick question. The service station point-of-sale system, are those already in place now for the gas tax?
Most service stations have a point-of-sale system. That's basically the, you know, when you put your credit card in the pump, that's what that is.
Yeah, and it just goes back to your earlier comment about we want to make sure we minimize any impact to the businesses, and I was just curious.
Oh, I got $5 to put gas in my vehicle, and I pull up to a station, and it reads it, and I owe them $6. I can't get any gas, right?
You want to talk about that?
Sure.
What we intend to do for that is have a display in the car that would say...
Oh, so we'll have a clue of what it's going to be.
Yeah. We're running a pilot project on this whole thing, and that's one of the things we've added to the pilot, is so that people know, I've got this many miles in Zone 1 and this many miles in Zone 2. And then ultimately, I think if this ever was implemented by a state, you'd have have the rate there as well, so you can see the dollars rolling up. And so you'd know, I need to go to the cash machine first.
Yeah, actually at the test site, which we'd be happy to show any of you, it's down at OSU on their campus. The system's set up right now to say, you know, your VMT fee is, you know, $3, you know, whatever it is, would you like to pay it? We're not sure that we would have the system actually set up like that, but that is how the test is set up. So it's really like a policy decision on whether or not you want a mandate collection or whether you want the option to wait and wait and wait. Here's the receipt, a sample receipt. As you can see, there's this motorist got 13 and a half gallons of gas. The fuel tax at 24 cents a gallon was deducted. And then the mileage fee, this person drove 243 miles, so was added on at 1.22 cents a mile. For the pilot, the fee will be 1.2 cents a mile, will be the basic Oregon rate. And then there you can see the total due. And at the test site, this actually happens right now. We actually have a simulation where this prints out.
Can you tell us how you came up with that 1.2?
Actually, that's fairly simple. The average vehicle gets approximately 20 miles per gallon in Oregon. And the gas tax rate is 24 cents. So if you do the division, you end up at 1.2 cents per mile.
Okay.
1.22,
well,
actually.
Earlier, you talked about when cars were getting 10 miles a gallon, and I was worried that you were going to try to apply that. That would be wonderful for everybody that's building roads, but I don't think the consumers would be too happy with
that. The rate is a policy decision for the legislature, ultimately. For the pilot, we do have authority to charge a rate, and this is what it's going to be.
Our proposal is that ultimately we would only put the technology in new vehicles. I shouldn't say we would put it. It would be put in only new vehicles at the manufacturer level, which, by the way, most of these components, by the time this would ever be enacted, will already be in vehicles. So it's a configuration question more than a hardware question. In the pilot, obviously, we're going to be retrofitting vehicles, about 280 of them. The device is, just so you know, it's a little box about this big that the people from OSU will be installing in the vehicles. But we don't propose that that be the case in full-scale implementation. Characteristics of collection. As some of this was stated earlier, the fuel tax would be maintained for non-equipped vehicles, and that's important for lots of reasons. One is it creates redundancy in case there's tampering with the device. It's not like you're not paying any taxes. You would basically, if you came in and there wasn't a reading, you would pay the mileage fee. Or for old cars, as the phase-in is occurring. Or for out-of-state cars. Obviously, if they're driving on our roads, we would want to somehow capture revenue from that, and we would just do that the way we do it now through the fuels tax. Oregon's weight mile tax would be retained for heavy trucks. This actually puts passenger cars in more line with how trucks are currently paying. And the last bullet point there is about peak period pricing, and that's what I mentioned earlier about the possibility of doing some sort of rush hour pricing. We will be doing that, a test in the pilot. It's really a policy decision in terms of where you want to go with that. privacy. As I said earlier, there's a lot of misconceptions about what the GPS in the pilot will be doing, but this has been a major concern from the get-go, and so the whole thing has been designed to address these issues, because the last thing we want to do is to have people think that government's tracking where they're going. So there is no vehicle location data stored in the vehicle or anywhere else. There literally is more information that can be gathered from the credit card transaction when they're getting their gas than from what we're doing. There's no data transferred except for that total number of miles driven in the zone. So there is a piece of new information, and that is it. That's if one of you drove 300 miles in Oregon, I suppose ODOT would know that. And the data is only transferred via shortwave radio frequency at the fueling stations. And that also is to address privacy. It could have been done back through the GPS, but that's not the case because people are concerned about privacy and communication being out there. So it's a limited short-range communication. We're trying to design it so it will go about the length of a fuel hose. Cost. You're probably wondering, this must be very expensive. As we said, we do not anticipate retrofitting vehicles, and the components would be stalled during manufacture. Now, obviously, we have to deal with the manufacturing industry to get that to happen, and we have been having some conversations. We met with Nissan yesterday, and they're the ones who really have kind of told us that a lot of these components are going to already be in vehicles. The capital cost is really where the service stations are concerned, because of the readers that have to be placed there and the point of sale systems that will have to be, the software changes that will have to be made in order to make this work. That has been estimated at $33 million, and the proposal right now is that that would be bonded and it would increase the rate by about 2% in the actual mileage fee if you wanted to do it that way. A lot of this has already been said. The system is less risky because it is redundant, and we also we think it's pretty solid in terms of evasion possibilities. There is a backup, which is the gas tax. This was a really good day for us. May 14th, which I noticed the date has dropped off the slide, but May 14th, this past year in Corvallis, we had our first test of this whole process. They have engineered a mock service station where we actually had a task force meeting down there, and there were members of the media there and members of the legislature there. We drove around in the cars, watched the zone switch. We had a little laptop set up so everyone could see. And all of the things that we were trying to do showed that it worked successfully in the test. These were the policy requirements that Jim mentioned earlier, and through the test, we have checked them all off in terms of working as far as we've gone so far. Now, the next task is to see if we can make all this work in a pilot, where we have real motorists and real service stations and real cars conducting this experiment with us. These are the policy issues that you all at some point will decide whether or not you want to discuss. Retrofitting versus the long phase-in, that was something I've talked about already. You know, if you didn't want a retrofit and you wanted everyone to get on the new system right away, then obviously you would want to put the devices in the vehicles. But if you don't, then it's about a 20-year phase-in to eventually get the fleet to turn over so that all cars, or most cars, I should say, would be on the new system. The second is setting the mileage fee rate. That obviously is full of controversy. I'll tell you honestly, because maybe you will get some of these questions yourself, that the two questions that we get the most is the privacy one, which we anticipate and we gladly answer, and the second is the rate, and not the rate in general, but why are you punishing me for driving a fuel-efficient vehicle? I've made a good choice, and why are you going to charge me more? So this issue, one of the things we tell them is the rate doesn't have to be flat. For the pilot, it is flat, but that really is a policy decision that you all are going to have to decide, is do you want to graduate the rate based on fuel efficiency or emissions or some other standards? Just something to be aware of. The third thing there is the requirements on vehicle manufacturers. We, lately at a presentation when I was talking about this, I made a comment about how, you know, Oregon isn't, you know, we are a fairly small state, and if we were to do something like this by ourselves, the likelihood that the auto manufacturers would just be like, oh yeah, let me do it, it's probably not very likely. For some reason, they all laughed in the room because most of the people there were from California and they knew exactly what we meant. But if there were other states or a group of states who were going to do something like this, our chances may be more likely. So it's just something, again, to keep in mind as we go forward. How would the interstate system be standardized? Again, big question there. We have made some headway on this. Like I said, there's a whole group of people who work on intelligent transportation systems in the whole country, and it's mostly the auto manufacturers along with Hitachi and a bunch of other high-tech companies, and they have developed a national architecture for this type of communication. So there is some standards out there that we are pretty close to meeting already, and now knowing what we know, can make a few changes and won't be too far out of what's already happening nationally. And then how does this integrate with the federal solution? So that is, they're having the same problem we're having. So how do you deal with that? Oops. This is our timeline for the pilot. We anticipate beginning in November of this year with the 280 vehicles. It will be in Eugene is our expectation. Before that, we'll have 20 vehicles in a test, basically, and that'll be people like Jim and I and any of you if you would like to participate in our test. The full pilot will be the 280 vehicles, like I said. It'll be the first time that we are aware of in the world that a mileage fee will be paid and a gas tax will not. So it's big time. And we will have a group that will participate in this rush hour group, like I said. That'll be a weekday rush hour time zone that will be drawn in Eugene. We haven't even drawn it yet, where those people will pay a different rates altogether. They'll pay a significantly less rate for their Oregon miles, their general miles, and they'll pay a significantly higher rate for their rush hour miles. It's supposed to work out to be about the same as the 1.2 cents a mile for the purposes of our pilot. And that's our website where we put every single thing that we've ever done. And if you or any of your constituents have questions, that's a good place to point them.
Thank you very much. Very informative, I appreciate it. Questions?
I got the video.
Yes, after.
Yes, thank you. You kind of touched on it a little bit, but where else is this technology being used? Is it being used anywhere else?
The actual mileage fee itself is not, but there is tons of work being done with what's called dedicated short-range communication all over the country, where they're doing experiments with where cars are driving and they get real-time information about traffic issues that are ahead, and it involves a lot of the same technology components that we're talking about. But nowhere are they doing a mileage fee like we're doing. There is a couple other mileage fee type of projects, but we don't consider them to be very realistic because they involve taking smart cards out of devices and sending them into the DOT and getting something back and putting it in your car. And our whole point was to make this no different than what it already is for you and for me. So there is some other work being done, but we don't consider it to be as well thought through as ours.
If I may add, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, we know of a major automobile manufacturer that is planning to put OnStar, which is a GPS-based device you may have heard of, into all of its models beginning in 2007. They haven't announced it yet, so I don't want to disclose this in public, but this is our information. That's the kind of thing that's happening without any government intervention.
And that technology, for the most part, is way more advanced than what we would need to do this.
So maybe just a comment that, yeah, my constituents raised huge concerns about the privacy issue, and so that would be paramount that we protect that.
We agree. And one more point, the way that the OnStar works is it does send another signal out so that tracking can be enabled. And the whole purpose is so that...
But it would be voluntary.
That would be voluntary, and the way that we would propose to use it, if we propose it at all, would be that we would only receive the signal, have no transmission out. So there is no storage of vehicle movements or ability to track movements. The only thing that would be transmitted is a mileage number at service stations, nothing else. We were very aware of why that was important when we designed things this way.
I just had a quick question. Whose idea was it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, for what?
To do this.
Oh, the legislature. 2001 said, please investigate an alternative to the gas tax, and it was called the Road User Fee Task Force, and there are four legislators, sitting legislators, sitting on it now.
Sure. Was this something that, was it Representative or Governor Kitzhaber that
Governor started that? Yeah, Governor Kitzhaber came up with the VMT tax around 96 or something, and but it didn't go anywhere. It wasn't practical at that point. So this is another investigation of something similar.
Thank you, Chair. And really, thank you for... It's so nice to actually be looking forward at something instead of... So often we're all stuck dealing with the backlog maintenance, all the things we haven't done. It's nice to actually be able to look ahead and try and get out ahead of something, especially in advance of other states. Let me just throw out three questions, and you can deal with them however you want. Explain the zones a little bit more and why that would be a need instead of just keeping one zone that would be Oregon.
Yeah.
Two, are there any savings? You talked about the cost. Are there any savings that would be accrued? Like, do service stations get a percentage of the gas tax as an administrative fee today, or are there any other savings like that? And three, we've authorized you, I think, to just do this one pilot. Is there any benefit for the kind of information we're going to want back in the future of authorizing you to do future pilots during this session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, the zones, there's a number of policy questions that will be developed as we go along. The first zone is, you're right, the state of Oregon, and the second zone would be outside the state of Oregon. Under the terms of our Federal Highway Administration grant, which is funding two-thirds of this work, they wanted us to look at congestion pricing. So we have created, for the purposes of the pilot, congestion zones to test that possibility. But you want to have the ability to have more than one zone for purposes of addressing issues like local option, for example. If there would be a local option, should there be a local option on this? So there are multiple zones. It's something that's worth developing technologically. Whether you actually do it, though, they're separate questions. That's completely separate questions, and you could address one of them and not the others. Let's see, I've already forgotten the second question.
Savings.
Savings. We haven't looked at savings yet, those little things. Those kinds of issues, there's a lot of issues that the service station industry would like to look at, again, when you open up a new system. And I think anything you can imagine will be brought up to the table as you develop a legislation on a new system, yes.
And another pilot?
Another pilot. Our view is this will gather a lot of interest. It will prove that something could be done. It'll be on the shelf and ready to go. But that I would think that if a legislature actually wanted to enact this, they would want to look at a couple more pilots to make sure everything works really nicely before we switch over. Sure, there's a lot of work. The technology last May that we looked at, I consider it the Model T. If you want to come up to date, you've got to do a lot more work. It's got to work every single time.
Well, we don't need the authority to do that.
We can run more than one pilot up until January 2nd, 2010. But we'd have to have additional funding to do that, and because we've got to hire people to do it and all that kind of thing. But we could run more pilots under this program up to 2010. If a legislature wanted to enact this, I think you'd want further more actual investigations before you actually do the on switch.
I'm saying, Burley.
Three questions. I'm interested in how the interaction with the federal system goes. for example, I don't have any idea how the federal gas tax is allocated to Oregon. You know, is it?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, there isn't a flat standard formula for allocation of the gas tax. It's done on a budgetary basis, and I'm not looking in that magic box, so I can't tell you. This system couldn't cover the federal gas tax. The federal gas tax would still be applied because we can't impact that tax. They are very interested in what we're doing. That's why they're funding it 2/3. So I think at some point, if this really gets to be a serious implementation discussion, you have a lot of discussions with the federal government as well.
The one-way communication from the satellite, not being a GPS expert, I'm a little curious how the onboard unit would know whether or not you're inside or outside of Oregon without transmitting something up to the satellite.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, how does a television set get a signal and put a picture on the screen? How does a radio do the same kind of thing? I'm a lawyer. I'm not a technology expert. If the committee would like to have that kind of, we have the people available at OSU to do it, and they've done this in a number of places. They were back in Washington, D.C. with us when we made a presentation before the Transportation Research Board in January, and we could have them in, and they're professors, so they actually know how to speak to people who don't know things from the they're not experienced, so that would be something worthwhile, perhaps.
Well, I don't know if the whole committee would be interested in that, or I...
Well, there's two of us for sure that
the members are factors.
Okay. I plan on it. Yeah. And John, you didn't hear this, but we're going to get some more information on how the GPS system works. Because okay. I don't understand how it can just be one-way communication either. In my airplane, I think
I'll go both ways. If I may, I'll add one thing. The purposes of the signal is to tell the computer in the car, where do you put the miles? Where do you store the miles? Is it in this field, field A, field B, field C? And so the signal says, I'm in Oregon, I'm in Oregon, I'm in Oregon, I'm not in Oregon. And that's where it changes.
And I understood that clearly, yeah. But I just need to be satisfied,
sure.
Someone that understands the technology, that the only way it knows I'm in Oregon, I'm in Oregon, I'm in Oregon, I'm not, is not because my vehicle's sending something up to it.
Yeah, and that's a very reasonable investigation, I think.
And one last question, please. Betsy, I thank you for taking the time last week to visit with me about this on the phone, and I'd like a little more clarification on what we discussed with respect to a control within this pilot. In other words, are we going to have vehicles that are going to be tracking the miles traveled but paying the regular gas tax so we can have some idea of the trade-offs there?
That is right. In the design of the sample of the people who are going to be participating, there will be a certain amount, and I'm not sure how many at this time, of motorists who will be in the study, and they will have the equipment, but they will be paying the gas tax. There will be no change except they will have the equipment, and that as to serve as a control group for the study.
Will the control group be stratified so we have different economy classes that we can look at that?
That is all being designed by the professors at PSU who are designing that element of the project for us. And there will be stratifications. I'm not sure what those look like, but I'd be happy to get that to you. I'm sure they've got some ideas about what that's going to be.
Okay, thanks.
And I just want to add, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you or at all interested in a little field trip, we'd love to have you down at OSU to go through the simulation, because it really is a neat experience, and it's in the OSU Tsunami Wave Lab, so you can also see them run a wave, which is very cool.
Thank you. Bonus. Further questions?
Yes. Yeah, actually, I did. Thank you. I had a couple more. What about towed vehicles or vehicles on a trailer that, you know, they're not on? Would it only be activated if the vehicle's on?
Question one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think that's exactly how it would work. I mean, if the vehicle's not operating, it wouldn't run the miles.
And also, would there be a differentiation between county and private and state streets? I mean, within a zone, there could still be a variation of, you know, city, county, state. private roads here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, at this point, we haven't gone into that level of detail to figure out how to. The county and the city would be included, but private roads, we haven't gone into that analysis yet. With enough computing power, they tell me, the professors tell me, that you could excise out about anything that isn't appropriate.
John, you had a question.
I was just curious. Once a vehicle shifts over to this new technology, what at that point, would they still have the option of paying the gas tax versus this differential fee, or would they be required to pay this fee and not have be able to comparison shop between whether it's better for them to pay the gas tax versus this fee?
Mr. Chairman, Administrator Hauser, this is a policy question. Our concept is that you pay one and not the other, and that the whole idea is to develop a stop loss on fuel efficiency improvements for the vehicles that are going to make a dramatic impact on road revenues. So our concept is you don't have the option. You pay one or the other. But, again, that's up for the legislature to decide if they want to implement this at some point.
Further questions?
Yeah, sure.
During any kind of lengthy transition period to this new technology, how difficult will it be to estimate the revenue stream that is going to continue to come from the gas tax or this new fee? How accurate can those kind of estimates be as you transition from one technology to the other?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Administrator Hauser, again, you're talking to a lawyer, not a statistician or an economist, but judging from what I've seen in ODOT's ability to work with numbers, I think that fairly high reliability, yes.
I don't have any further questions. Thank you. It's very informative, and we very well take you up on a trip. And where do you sign up? My truck doesn't get 20 miles per gallon, so this is a good deal for me.
It is. We're planning on doing it in Eugene. I want to remind you.
Anything further to come for the committee? Transportation Committee is adjourned.